Get Published, Episode 19, for Sunday, November 29th, 2009. Hi there, and welcome to Get Published. I'm your host, Mike Plested. Well, NaNoWriMo is almost over for another year. For some of us, it's a time of celebration because we've met the challenge and conquered it. For others, they're still in the fight. Either way, congratulate yourself for every new word that has met paper, because really, that is the whole point to NaNoWriMo. This episode is a bit bittersweet for me. On the one hand, I am absolutely thrilled to finally have T. Morris on the show. T. is one of the people who actually got me interested in podcasts and podcasting to start with. His Survival Guide to Writing Fantasy is one of the must-listen-to podcasts for writers. The bitter comes from the fact that Survival Guide is at the end of its run. That's bad news for we fans of the show, but reflects T's burgeoning career. And we can still hear his melodious tones on Birdhouse Rules, so all isn't lost. Thanks for joining me.
Why is it that you persist in saving the humans, Elena? Is it love? Is it nostalgia for what we once were? What purpose could you possibly have that could not be better served by a heart of gears and steam?
Jonathan Andrews thought that his life was turned upside down when he joined a secret society of wizards, but he had no idea what was in store for him. Join Jonathan and the others as they delve through the mystery that threatens all life on the planet. Listen to the free podcast at thegearheart.com.
Please hang up and try again.
And now we're on to the feedback section of the show, and for this episode I got a question from Jack Jaffe about publisher offers. Specifically, when should you take one and when shouldn't you?
Hello, Get Published. This is Jack Jaffe, author of Down the Road and Baker's Dozen, the first interactive audio fiction adventure podcast available at 12volttheater.com. Ding. Okay, now my question. In baseball, you don't always swing at the first pitch. My question is, when should you not take up an offer a publisher makes? For instance, you send off your manuscript, and now you get this acceptance letter. Are there certain terms or conditions in a contract that you should say, ooh, and back away from right away? Or should you just take an offer when it comes because, hey, you got an offer?
Hey, Jack. Wow, that's a tough question to answer for a couple of reasons. First, because I'm not a contract expert, and also because only you as the author can really say what you're willing to sell. For example, you may have your heart set on podcasting your story, and therefore you don't want to give up electronic rights to the manuscript. There are also a few things you might want to pay close attention to. For example, if the publisher is a small one that only has local presence for distribution, you probably want to hold on to your international rights. After all, the press won't be likely able to do anything with them, so why would you give them away? The same may be true of movie or television rights. If they don't or can't deal in that arena, you don't want to sell the rights away because you're closing a door to a possible future sale. Watch for clauses that prevent the rights of the work from reverting to you if the press goes out of business or if they don't do anything with your book for a period of time. The last thing you want to do is sell your work for a small advance and have the publisher either sit on it or go bankrupt. In both cases, you might be able to buy your work back, but you also may never see another penny out of it. Personally, for my first book, anyway, I probably won't be too shy about what a publisher requests for rights. I will try to keep electronic rights for podcasting, but I won't insist on it. I'll also look at how long the work needs to be out of print before the rights revert back to me. There is one thing I will never do, and that is sign a contract that expects me to pay for any part of the publishing process. Keep in mind, the money should be flowing to the author, not away from him or her. Thanks for your question, Jack. And if you have any feedback, comments, or questions, You can reach me via my voicemail line at 206-203-2031. Or you can also email me at feedback@getpublishedpodcast.com. Whichever method works for you, I encourage you to send me any questions, comments, or feedback you may have.
Our lives echo across time and space, intersecting with the echoes of other lives. For every intersection, a new story is told. 10 lives are about to intersect. 10 stories are about to be told. Miranda is reaping what she has sown. Mitchell understands that there is no resisting fate. Clint dreams of forging a violent destiny. Elizabeth is about to make a discovery. Robin hides a terrible secret. Simon hasn't slept in 10 days. Sam is pursued by his nightmares. Susie is far from home. David has just been found. Jake is atoning for past evils. 10 ordinary people struggling to keep their sanity in an insane world. Emergent Publishing proudly presents Chinese Whisperings, The Red Book, a conceptual anthology of interconnected short stories from 10 emerging writers from around the world, coming soon in January 2010. For more information, check out the Chinese Whisperings website at ChineseWhisperings.com.
Danger, incoming interview.
I am absolutely thrilled to welcome T. Morris to the show. T. is an actor, podcaster, author, and champion of social media. He is the co-founder of Podiobooks.com, co-author of Moravi, The Chronicles of Rafe and Ascana, author of the Billabub Batting series of books, and several non-fiction books, the latest of which are All a Twitter and Twitter in 10. I could go on for several minutes on T's accomplishments, but instead I will post those in the show notes for your perusal. So without further ado, I give you T. Morris.
Exactly, exactly.
And you mentioned that you have 4 books written in the industry. 2 of those are just out, really. All of Twitter and Twitter in 10. Can you tell us a little bit about them?
Oh, sure, sure. I'll actually start with All of Twitter, work on Twitter in 10, and then talk a little bit about what I've got coming up from the same publisher. So I also feel like because we're talking about getting published, I think I should also tell the story behind getting published, behind Absolutely. you know the experience of getting the contract for All of Twitter. For one thing, it's something I would tell people when they're starting off is it's very important to have an agent. It's very, very important to have an agent. You know, you hear people talk about that. But if for some reason the agent checks out on you, it's going to be up to you. You know, you cannot become, I've heard a lot of people say, it's not my job. I've heard a lot of professional authors say, it is not my job to do X, Y, Z.
Right.
Whether it's promotion or something like that. Well, you know what? To me, that's reliance that you need to keep in check, and you need to be very, very cautious about practicing. And what I mean by that is the story behind All of Twitter. So we've been trying to make this book All of Twitter happen, and so far it's been zip. You know, it's been absolutely nada. You know, we can't seem to get All of Twitter finalized, and. So I'm sitting there and I'm saying, come on, we got to get this. Well, and the agent says to me, well, you know, T, they're obviously not interested. So why don't you just go ahead and just let it lie? And I was like, I don't want to. I really think there's something here. So how about we do this? Let me reach out one more time. And my agent, this is my agent for my nonfiction, not to be confused with my agent in fiction. I'll talk about her a little later. She says, okay, if you feel like that's really that important, you go on ahead. So I reach out to the publisher one more time and I say, you know, look, I'm out here. I didn't know if you were still interested in the idea. I'm still interested in working with you guys. And she writes me back. And she says, what are you doing tonight? I said, well, I'm going to be on the road. You know, you can call me at this number. And sure enough, that night I get a phone call. And I got a phone call from the publisher, and she is talking to me about this book, All the Twitter, and how quickly we can turn it around. So then as I'm talking to this woman, my agent calls me on the phone. So I said, let me put you on hold. So I put the publisher on hold. I'm on the phone with the agent. I go, all right, I sent the follow-up this week, and she wrote me back. In fact, she's on the phone right now, and she's negotiating the contract. What do I do? And I kid you not, the agent says to me, well, why aren't you going ahead and you're doing so well with her? Why don't you go ahead and wrap that up? Now, at that point, one of these quote unquote professionals who say that's not my job would have said, no, you do your job. This isn't my thing, blah, 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 blah. And they'd hang up and then pretty much the deal would probably gone south.
Right.
But I was like, okay. And yeah, I'm a little mad that it was up to me to, you know, to finish this deal. But basically, I finished the deal. We struck a deal as best as I could. You just had to think fast. And I thought to myself, you know, okay, if this completely goes pear-shaped, all right. But, you know, I gave it my best shot. I just know that this agent that I've got is probably not thinking wasn't really thinking very well. But we did.
Yeah, definitely yeah. Not working on your behalf, that's for sure.
No. And you know, I hate to dog my agent the way this is, but you know, in all honesty, this is the same agent that failed to tell me and Evo Terra when we wrote Podcasting for Dummies that it was a for dummies book we were pitching.
Oh,
she said, why didn't you use the specs? You know, we're talking about the table of contents. She goes, why didn't you use the specs I gave you? And I said, what specs? And she's like, oh, I forgot to send you the specs. Hold on. And then boom, a contract for John Wiley and Sons for Dummies shows up in our mailboxes. And so, you know, at one point I was tolerant of it, but the past couple of decisions that she's made of late have made me realize that you need to be as self-sufficient as you can be when you get into publishing. And All of Twitter almost didn't happen, but fortunately it did happen, and that came out in record time. I mean, I wrote that book from beginning to end in roughly 3.5-4 months.
Wow.
Actually, it was closer to 3 months. It's closer to 3 months. Yeah, I started work on it in February, and let's say February, March, April. Yeah, 3 months. And then in May, we were going over line edits.
Yeah, I mean, that's fast. That's really fast.
Well, and the thing is, the second book that I had come out, which was Teach Yourself Twitter in 10, Sam's Teach Yourself Twitter in 10 Minutes, that came out, that was written within a 2-month time span. The way I was able to shave time off that was that Q, after we were doing line edits, Q said, yeah, we've been real happy with how you performed with All the Twitter. Would you be willing to do Sam's Teach Yourself Twitter in 10? And I said, okay, well, can I use the tutorials from All the Twitter and modify them for Teach Yourself Twitter in 10? She said, absolutely. And so the amazing thing was that just between All of Twitter and Twitter in 10, there were already so many changes that came out. I was literally doing, it wasn't just cutting and pasting. I had to basically talk about where all of the stuff had moved to, where this was located, where that was located. A lot of stuff had changed between All of Twitter and Teach Yourself Twitter in 10.
Right.
The way I describe the difference between the two books is that All of Twitter happens, All of Twitter covers more the philosophy of Twitter. Not just how you work Twitter, but why you work Twitter. It goes into my own approaches to Twitter and how you make Twitter work best for you. Teach Yourself Twitter in 10 minutes. Well, the title pretty much says it all. You want to get in, you want to learn how Twitter works, and you want to get out. You don't care what the philosophy of Twitter is. You just want to know how it works. And so I was able to cover some of the changes that had happened between All of Twitter and now. And then I was able to, you know, build on that and talk more about some more of the different services that were out there, like Moby Picture, 12 seconds, that sort of thing.
Right. So, go ahead.
I was just going to say, and again, I had some communication problems with my agent. And again, I found myself on my own trying to make the deal happen. And what I stressed to people that are trying to get into the business is that just because you have an agent and just because you, someone is quote unquote doing the footwork for you, it doesn't mean that you shouldn't know certain things about the business. You need to know as much about the business and also how to deal with people as best as possible. And that way, in case you find yourself in a situation like I did, I mean, these were two books that may have not happened had it not been for me stepping up and saying, no, I'm okay with doing this. I will take the bull by the horns and I will take care of it. And that's for my nonfiction. I just picked up a new editor. I picked up a new agent in fiction. And I have to unlearn a lot of the stuff that I'm doing on my own, which I'm okay with because this new agent, she's wonderful. She's just fantastic. And I met her out at a World Fantasy Convention this year. And it was a delightful time. It was a very impulsive trip. I wasn't planning on taking the trip, but I did. And I'm very happy that I did. It was a real education.
Excellent. And what did you do? Like, how did you go about actually making contact with that agent and moving forward?
Well, now there's a story in itself. One of the things that's great about being an author is you, a lot of times you'll have a story for everything. And the story behind this agent search, actually, I have to hold Pip Ballantyne to task. She's responsible for this. She's responsible for this interview. So what exactly happened? So what happened was that Pip and I were very casually working on this idea. We were just very, very, we were working on this idea for a steampunk novel, and we started tinkering around with it. And when I say tinker, I was like, well, let's just write it a little bit and let's see what happens.
Right.
And well, within the first month and a half, first month and a half, we wrote roughly 50,000 words together.
That's impressive.
Yeah. And we were like, wow. Okay. You know, wow. And of course we were thinking, well, that's probably because we've got two authors involved, so we have a lot of good things going for us. Well, then we stepped away from it. Stepped away from it because I had to work on all of Twitter and Twitter and 10. Well, just as I'm wrapping stuff up for Twitter and 10, just as I'm wrapping it up, during all this, Pip signs a New York contract. And when she signed the New York contract, she went onto her blog and she started talking about different ideas that she was working on. And she mentioned a steampunk novel that she was co-writing with me. Well, she had signed this contract, and apparently there are these production companies. I didn't realize this actually happened, but this is kind of cool. These production companies out there actually look up these different magazines like Locus Online. They want to see who's signing what. And they see Pip sign this two-book deal. So they look up Pip on the web, and they see this steampunk idea. So they instantly ping Pip's agent, and they say to her, they say, we're in the market for some steampunk property. How soon can she be finished? So the agent contacts Pip. Pip says, well, this is a co-written thing. The agent then contacts me and says, I'll represent you.
Nice.
And that was how it happened. And now the funny thing is, she had seen an early draft of the first chapter and it was a mess. And she said, this would never work. those are her exact words. This will never work. She said there was a potential there, but right now I can't even read this. So we went back and we tweaked it. We tweaked, we obviously went back, and when we started seriously working on it, we tweaked it for whatever it was worth. And the agent said, can you have the manuscript done by the end of August? And of course, this was the beginning of August. And I had just gotten the job, but just gotten a brand new job. And we both said, yes. So we started going. I mean, we started writing. And the funny bit was that the original chapter that the agent said, she just said, we can't do a thing with this. suddenly became, where's the next chapter? I'm impatiently waiting for it. I have to read it first, and now I'm hooked. So she is 100% behind this idea, and that to me is part of what makes an agent a really good agent, is that they get a vested interest in what you're doing. And that was how I got on board. I got aboard with this agent through Philippa Ballantyne, and she's done Pip's done a yeoman's job playing middleman between the two of us, and now finally, you know, I've met her and we've talked, and she's now interested in looking at some of my other stuff. But right now, I'm kind of focused on getting Books and Brawn done.
Well, congratulations on the new agent. That sounds really promising.
Yeah, and that's one of the other things that I tend to tell people. You know what I mean? You know, the thing about the agent is that the agent is supposed to do a lot of the messy work, so that all you have to do is write. Now, just because that's what they're supposed to do doesn't mean that's what's going to happen. And what you have to realize is that the agent, I mean, I'm looking at it from a very Pollyanna point of view, but really the agent has to care about what you're writing.
True.
The agent has to care about what you're writing. And I've seen a lot of friends get burned by agents. And I'm not just talking about sham agents. I'm talking about real high profile agents. And a lot of it had to do with the fact that the agent just stopped caring about what they did. So if an agent stops caring about what you're doing, or really if an agent just stops caring about the actual job itself, then chances are that's not a good fit for you, at least in the early days. I mean, you need somebody that not only has the agent not only has to have a good sense of business, but the agent also has to have a passion and a drive. And maybe, you know, I think I may be going out on a limb here, but maybe some of the higher up agents, higher up on the food chain, they tend to look at it more from a business and less from a passionate perspective. They're more concerned about making the bottom line.
Yeah, that could be.
But agents, you know, when people say, well, what's the first thing I should do? I tell them, I say, look, you know, I got very lucky. But at the same time, I think I might have done things wrong by not having an agent early on in my career, which is why it's taken me a little longer to get to certain places. Now, it doesn't mean that I chose the wrong path. It's just that the path that I chose was more of the scenic route. I mean, you know, I find that, you know, when people say, well, yeah, T, you really should have gotten an agent early on in your career, I say, well, is that really true or not? Because I've had friends who have had the agents early on in the career, and while, yeah, they're further along than they are with me, I have to ask myself, what did they learn that was different from what did I learn differently from what they've learned?
Right.
Now, they're basically saying, yeah, I'll give you a good example. There's a friend of mine that, he's had an agent, and he is a major, he's with a major fantasy publisher, and now he's being asked to write under a pen name.
Oh.
And I was like, why? And he said, well, my agent and my publisher both said
is that your phone?
That's mine.
Oh, that's your phone. Okay. the magic of podcasting. But the agent basically said, and the publisher basically said that the sales are down. So were you going to do this, and you're going to try this, and maybe this will make things better? A pen name. Now, see, to me, no, I would never write under a pen name. If the agent and the editor, or the agent and the publisher, would refuse to work with me under my own name, I'm like, then you know what? This isn't going
to
work.
Yeah, it's time to move on.
Yeah, because I don't want to dupe people like that. I want people to know that when they pick up a T. Morris novel, or they pick up anything with my name on it, it's something they can trust.
Right.
Now, you know, and now granted, they've had a, now we can still argue that they've had a more fruitful writing career, because that's all they do. But where I'm looking at it from my perspective, from my perspective on my publishing career, is my fiction where I want it to be? No. but I have a different type of, type of career. I'm not the flash in the pan. I'm a slow burn.
Right.
You know, I started with Moravi and I,
excuse me. And I, sorry about that.
That's okay. And I wrote Billy and, you know, and these are two books that I'm extremely proud of. And they were with a small publisher. And in that interim, I also wrote some articles for their Complete Guide to Writing series, Complete Guide to Writing Fantasy. And they have a few others that are coming out too. And also with Dragon Moon Press, I was able to get some experience as an editor. So I got to see a different perspective. I got to see the world from the editor's chair, which was a very daunting place to be. Then in the middle of all of this, my small publisher said, you know, it's up to you to publicize. And I said, well, I got this great idea. What if I podcast my novel? And she said, I have no idea what you're talking about. You know what? Why don't you go ahead and do that? That sounds great. And from there, I became the first author to ever podcast a novel from beginning to end. And from that, I got the gig with Podcasting for Dummies. And then from there, I wrote another podcasting title. And then with my involvement in podcasting, I got involved in the social media movement. I then wrote two books in social media. So I've got that backing behind me. People know me for podcasting. People know me for Twitter. But they also are finding out, oh, wow, he also does fiction. And I just found out just recently that all of Twitter, it came out this summer in July, and it's already in its third printing.
Wow.
So I'm thrilled with that. I'm absolutely thrilled with those numbers that we're doing as well as we're doing. And it feels good because I'm as proud as I am of Podcasting for Dummies, I think I'm even more proud of all of Twitter because I've had a lot of the comments that I've received from people concerning all of Twitter is they'd never got Twitter. They didn't understand Twitter. And then they read my book and they go, I get it. You know, I get it. People didn't have to get podcasting. They just had to jump in and do it.
Right.
But with Twitter, it's, as you know, with Twitter, it's a very different feel. And I've actually been taking all these experiences with nonfiction and with fiction when in all honesty, I wouldn't have gotten these nonfiction opportunities if it hadn't been for my fiction, which, you know, it all kind of ties back in together. And now I'm on the cusp of possibly getting my first step into a larger, larger publisher with possibly someone else doing some heavy lifting.
Right.
And yet there are still some things that I would ask. And I did turn to the publisher and say, not the publisher. I turned to my agent. And I said, there's one thing I would really like to do. If everything works out great, not only will you lock in this contract, and she is hell bent on leather to lock in the contract, this book. She really is its first screaming groupie fan, which is great. If you're going to have one fan, have it be your agent.
Yeah. No kidding.
But I said, I'd really like to have the big publisher agree to let us podcast because that's going to help us sell books. And because the way Pip and I want to podcast Books and Brawn, it's going to be slightly innovative. And the other thing that's going to be fun about Books and Brawn is that we actually did a reading of Books and Brawn at World Fantasy. And we were having a blast doing it. And the people that were attending the reading, they were enjoying it as well. So that there was just this very, very positive vibe. And if we could, I know if we were allowed to podcast our novel, it would actually help sales. And if we had a big publisher behind it, a la Scott Sigler and Crown, that'd be even better.
Right. No, that sounds really awesome. And I mean, you know this as well as I do, the real positive aspect of social media and podcasting is the interaction with your fans. You know, it's that back and forth with the fans. That's what really makes the experience rich.
Yeah, I agree. And the one thing is you have to realize is that just because that you're just because that you have this contact, because you know you're releasing your work into the wild, it doesn't necessarily mean that everyone's going to dig it.
No, very true.
Not everyone's going to dig it, and I mean, it's funny. I've heard many people refer to me as one of the best podcast authors out there. I've been called one of the greatest the greatest secrets of fantasy that's out there. I've also been called a hack. I've also been called a total failure. I've been there are people that think that Moravi Remastered is a triumph, and I've heard some people say Moravi Remastered was a total failure. I've heard people say that Billabub Battings was one of the coolest podcasts they ever listened to, and I've heard some people say that they found Billabub Battings totally amateurish. And the way that I look at the bad reviews, I cherish them as much as the good reviews, because to me, that is almost I'm trying to think of a good word for it. It's validating. That's the word. Validating is validation that I'm digging this, because if people really didn't like my work as much as these bad reviews said they were, why aren't they taking the time to write a bad review? there's these the great, and it's words I live by. The great Oscar Wilde once said, "There's one thing worse than being talked about, and that is not being talked about."
Yeah, yeah,
you know. And it took me a long. It took me a while to understand how witty that was. I mean, some of his other sayings, like when he, like, apparently there's a story where Oscar Wilde was entering the United States, and customs stopped him and said, "Do you have anything to declare?" And he said, "Only my brilliance." And that one I get right away, but I didn't quite understand the whole talked about, not being talked about. And then it just one day, I think it was when I was struggling with it, and I got a bad review. And then I was like, oh, wait a minute. They took the time to write that. Yes, and yeah. I mean, the only person I think that really made bad reviews an art form, I mean, and that's, and he, you know, he even said it before he passed away, was the dear beloved Joe Murphy. When he wrote a bad review, when Joe wrote a bad review, man, it was the shot heard around the world. He wrote a bad review once for a book that every time I read this bad review, it had me in tears because it was so freaking funny. I told him once, I said, I really want to write a bad book just so you'll write a bad review of it. And But Joe said, "Don't ever write a bad book, T, because I'll hunt you down." You know, I mean, Joe was another person that you really wanted to have in your corner, because he was a book critic and he was one of my biggest fans. But going back to what I was saying was that I really think that when you see a book that has all of these brilliant, wonderful 5-star reviews, I'm like, is the book really that good? And I think sometimes when people get bad reviews and they go completely just nuts on it, I go, well, hang on a minute. Really look at the review and see what they had to say. I mean, if it was just somebody just looking to pick a fight, then, you know, there's nothing you can do to change that mind. Sure. However, if you find out that there's something legitimate or something that's actually outstanding in the review, learn from it. And the example I go back to is Joe Murphy. Joe loved Moravi. He loved Moravi, and I was just tickled by his review, not because it was this glowing review, but because he said, "I do have a few problems with this book," and he listed some of the problems. And one or two of the problems I corrected him on, but there was a third problem where I had nowhere else to go. He described the book as suffering from the Star Trek syndrome, in that everyone in Moravi and this parallel world, they were all speaking English.
Oh yes, right.
You know, and I'm like, and I thought to myself, he's got a point. And I had to think, how do I write around that? And sure enough, in the second book, in Legacy of Moravi, it was just bugging me while I was writing Legacy. I'm like, how do I work around this? And then I had a scene where the elves show up and they're talking to Queen Ascanna in Elvish, and then they stop, and then suddenly they start talking in English. Mm. And Rafe, you know, Ascon and Rafe, you know, step aside to talk about something. And Rafe go and Rafe says, "What was this journeyman thing that they were talking about?" And Ascon looked at Rafe and said, "Rafe, did you ever wonder why everyone here spoke your tongue?" And he looked at Ascon and he goes, and you know, typical English slash maybe even a little bit of American. "Well, I just assumed it was part of the higher learning here, you know." And Ascona goes on to talk about this dialect called journeyman, which is used across Narrowim, and it's used for the lower classes. And I go into this little, just this little, in this mini little info dump,
right,
where she explains what journeyman is and how the elves were actually bitch slapping Wraith because they were dumbing it down so that he could understand what he was saying. And Joe read that, and fortunately he read it before he passed away. But Joe read it, and he just said to me, he just called me up, and he said, "That was brilliant, T. That was just brilliant." So I was like, "That was for you, baby. It was all you."
Now, you've talked about being published both in nonfiction, and you've talked about being published in fiction. Can you maybe talk about what's similar and what's different between the two?
Well, for one thing, with nonfiction books, unless they're history books, you know, unless they're the in-depth look at unless they're the in-depth look at things like the life of John Adams or something like that.
Right.
You don't have years to work on it, especially if you're doing. Especially if you're doing the thing with computers. If you're doing anything with computers, you got to get that puppy. Well, once upon a time, it was you could get that puppy out within 4 to 6 months, and you were still you know, relevant.
Right.
Now, maybe you have 2 months. You got to crank that sucker out, and you got to crank it out butt fast. And my opinion is that if you really want to still keep your work relevant, then you can't stop when you're all done. You know, you cannot stop when it's all done. You've got to then turn around and start doing something like what I'm doing with what I do with my Twitter books is I go on ahead and I put together a podcast, and that's what I've been doing. That's what I've been doing to keep the books relevant and to keep the books interesting and to keep the books up to date. I do an audio addendum, and it's basically it's the podcast. And in the case of the Twitter books, it's called Birdhouse Rules, and that's found at birdhouserules.com. And
you beat me on the bell. I don't have a bell, so well done.
See, that's just it. Every podcaster should have a bell. And if you're wondering where I got the idea, I'll just be honest. You know, geekradiodaily.com and the addcast.net. So that's what that is in a nutshell what you have to do. And that's the challenge of writing nonfiction, is that the turnaround time is super, super quick. One of the big advantages of being a nonfiction author is that you tend to have also more venues where you can go and speak and promote and things like that. You can reach a larger audience with the nonfiction. And depending on your perspective or your the other P word, publisher, depending on your publisher and your perspective on whatever it is you're talking about, your voice can actually come through a lot clearer, this one guy on Twitter, Gary Snook, aka Odin One Eye, has actually spent a day on Twitter just mentioning the pop culture references that I would drop at a hat in all of Twitter. That's something I couldn't do in Teach Yourself Twitter in 10, because that was a strict format and I could only do certain things and so and so and such and such. But with all of Twitter, it was no holds barred. So I could do things like there's an application, I don't know if you ever used it or not, but it's called Destroy Twitter.
Mm-hmm. And
it's it's a third party client. And it's a very, very cool app. But the one thing I find a little goofy about it is that, and I don't mean goofy in a bad way, it just didn't really click with me, although some people really dig it. You can actually have these screens animate. And what they do is they slide back and forth. So when you go to certain departments, you slide back, slide forward, slide up, slide down, all these different things. And I kept thinking, I kept looking at it, and I kept thinking about young Frankenstein. And I thought about, you know, listen to me very carefully, put the candle back on the mantle. You know, I mean, you know, putting the candle back, making the place turn around. And so when I'm writing the chapter talking about how to master Destroy Twitter, I said, Destroy Twitter is great, you know, provided you can get past the sliding panels. But if you ever get lost, just remember, and I typed in all caps, put the candle back. And that made it all the way to the final printing.
Wow.
And that kind of freedom. Oh, I dig that. I dig that really a lot. And so, yeah, I mean, that to me is part of the fun of writing with that side of the brain, particularly with some of the subjects I've been doing. The challenge in writing nonfiction, though, is that you're being taken at fact.
Right.
You're being taken as fact. Not as, you don't have the same leeway with reality as you would when you're writing fiction. But, you know, with writing fiction, your focus is telling a good story. And if for some reason your facts, you know, there are some people that are just all about the details in the fiction. And my opinion is I'm willing to suspend disbelief. You know, case in point with Moravi, if I wanted to be factual about my pirates in Moravi, they'd all have syphilis, they'd all be losing their teeth, and nobody would look attractive enough for a queen to come on board their ship. And once the queen got on their ship, you'd have to fight the crew from stabbing her because she's bad luck.
Yep, that's true.
You know what? Those facts don't really work when you're telling a story. But when you're doing nonfiction, I can't go into nonfiction story, you know, nonfiction books and talk about the history of XYZ, but and make it up as I go. No, I can't do that. You shouldn't be doing that in nonfiction. In fact, you know, when you get busted with nonfiction, you know, and fabricating or telling tall tales, and you're writing nonfiction, you wind up like James Frye. And if you remember that little scandal, that was the guy that wrote, quote unquote, the most important book of the 21st century, according to Oprah Winfrey. And then it turned out that he fabricated most of the book.
No, very true. You're always going to get the people who are experts, quote unquote, in the field scrutinizing your book for any mistakes that you might have made.
Exactly.
And they're not afraid to call you on it.
Oh, no. Because that's what they do. But then you run into people like, for example, you know, Dan Brown. There are people that are out there that think that Dan Brown wrote a historical essay on on Jesus and his supposed wife and on, you know, Leonardo da Vinci. And I'm like, I mean, I actually had a conversation with somebody who thought that the Da Vinci Code was real. Now this brings me to writing fiction. This brings me to the challenge of writing fiction. The challenge of writing fiction, what it boils down to, you got to have good characters and you've got to have a really compelling story to tell. That is my modus operandi. I want to have good characters and I want to have a fun story to tell. And I think that's part of what I enjoy the most in writing my fiction. If I'm having a good time, I'm going to just make a bet the audience is going to have a good time.
Yes.
Now, that may not always be the case, but that's what I strive for. I strive to make sure that whatever I'm writing, it's a good time. And if I can distract you from the world for a few hours, then I've done my job. So I love writing me some fun fiction. I mean, it's very rewarding and it's a lot of fun. And I dig it whole hog. And I think the challenge is trying to do something that hasn't been done before. That's the greatest challenge of it. And a lot of times, you know, if you look at the great stories, people go, oh, that's so innovative. Oh, that's so interesting. Well, actually, it's probably been told before. It's just a variation on a theme.
Yes.
And there's nothing wrong with variations on a theme. So provided you can make the theme unique, you can make the theme your own. I mean, for example, you look at Infected. You know, you look at Scott Sigler's Infected. Mm-hmm. That is not the first story of an alien infestation that, you know, started at the microbial level and works its way through. I mean, there are lots of stories that you can pick out and say, yeah, that's a little bit like Infected. But what makes Scott's Infected so unique is the fact of how it's working. It's the fact of how he tells the story. And the other thing that makes it compelling is what makes Scott's Infected compelling are the characters. There are, you know, what I said that I cared about, I mean, and to be fair, you know, did I care about all the characters Infected? Not necessarily. You know, Infected is the work that everybody knows Scott for. Personally, my favorite of all his stuff is The Rookie. I'm a huge Rookie fan. And just listening to the recast of The Rookie made me realize how big of a fan I am, and particularly of that book. I'll give you another one that I'm also a big fan of with Scott Sigler. It's the one that's going to be coming out in this April, Ancestor. Mm-hmm. Now, with Ancestor, Scott, again, was not telling anything new. Scientists create in their lab something that goes horribly, horribly wrong. Good golly, that's every sci-fi creature feature we have on Saturday night.
True.
But what Scott did that was so cool about it was that Scott took it to the next level. Scott told the same story, but he told it Scott Sigler fashion. And I think that's what the challenge is. You know, if you don't have this incredibly new idea, you come up with an idea that you can spin and make it your own. And I think that's the authors. And it's one that if you were to ask me, well, what do you prefer? Do you prefer fiction or nonfiction? I go back to this. So far, nonfiction has been paying my bills. If I could get my fiction to pay my bills, I'll be thrilled. But even then, I'm not full time with my writing. I mean, I have a full time job.
Right.
You know, I've got things to take care of. Now, that doesn't mean that I don't see my writing one day just, you know, taking care of business. And once it does that, oh yeah, I'll be a happy man. but I don't mind, you know, writing with both sides of my brain, because to me, that shows that I'm not a flash in the pan. It shows. And I think that's why I encourage writers to write not just their fiction and what they're famous for, but they should also write nonfiction. They should try doing something that is that might make people go, wow, he's not only a good writer, he's smart. That kind of thing.
Well, I think there might be a couple of writers out there that you don't want to encourage them to try writing nonfiction because they might not be quite as clever as they think they are.
Well, again, it goes, but when you take on the mantle of nonfiction, what I tell people is, okay, we all know you're passionate about writing, and that's what a lot of the nonfiction writers tend to do, or rather fiction writers tend to do. They automatically start writing nonfiction on writing. And to me, that's, you know, and I've done that too. I mean, I'm guilty of that too. And I found it a little pretentious, because here I am, I've got one title under my belt and I'm writing an article on how to write compelling characters. Mm-hmm. And a lot of the stuff that I wrote, oh man, some people really brought me to task. Some of the heavy hitters, they were like, what do you, you know, for example, I talked about what makes good characters, what makes bad characters. And one of the characters that I encourage people to write into their fantasy were Bond villains. Now, people got on my case about that. And I said, okay, you want to hear an argument for the Bond villain? I'll just go ahead and come out with it. Auric Goldfinger. Auric Goldfinger, in my opinion, is the villain that when the Broccolis created him or created that screen persona, you know, Ian Fleming created Auric Goldfinger, but the Broccolis made Auric Goldfinger the Auric Goldfinger we know. Mm-hmm. And what a great exchange that has been quoted more than any Bond line. I defy anyone to bring me a line that has been quoted as much as Goldfinger. When Bond is there, he's strapped to the slab of gold and he looks at Goldfinger and he goes, do you expect me to talk? And that's when he turns around and he goes, no, Mr. Bond, I expect you to die.
Yes.
I mean, woo! And that is what makes a Bond villain such a great villain to play with in your universe. Why? Because they've got all the answers and they know it.
Yeah.
And they're cool about it. And they're so, and it's their arrogance that tips them over. And playing with those kind of villains is so much fun. And, you know, if you can't have fun doing what you're doing, it's going to come out. It's going to come out in writing. It comes out in any form of entertainment. When you watch, for example, Firefly, when you watch any of the episodes of Firefly, and then you go back and you watch the bloopers, you see all the stuff that's happening behind the scenes, and you realize it's amazing they got any work done on that show. But they're having a good time, and that's why I argue that show is as powerful as it is and still hasn't lost anything after, what, the decade? It's been off the air for, what, 10 years, and still it's got staying power, and it was only on for 13 seasons. It was only on for 13 episodes, not even that.
And not even in the right order.
And not even in the right order. But my point is that you got to have fun doing what you do. And to me, nothing is more fun than watching a good, solid Bond villain. So, but what I'm saying is that you got to, when you write nonfiction, you need to write about something that you're passionate about and something that is sort of disassociated with what you're doing. In my case, instead of writing nonfiction titles all about writing, I'm writing nonfiction titles on podcasting and Twitter, and on occasion I do I work with a blog called App Advice, where I talk about stuff for the iPhone. Mm-hmm. So that's great fun for me, and it keeps me sharp as a writer. So I think what's important for authors of any kind is that they're able to do that, or they're able to at least, you know, they're able to at least allow themselves some latitude, you know, just explore a bit, you know, go into, find out, you know, and then when people read your nonfiction, they go, wow, that was very educational. What else has he done? Suddenly go, oh crap, he's also writing with the other side of his brain. Let's see what this is like. Yeah. Sometimes it works, sometimes it doesn't, but you know what? The worst thing you can do in life is just say, what if?
True. Very true. Well, and I have to give you credit. I know that you are the self-proclaimed Uber nemesis. And some people have agreed to that title. And I think I would go with it as well. Yours was probably, well, yours and Murr's. And I've lost track of which one I heard first, but I heard your podcast and Murr's first.
You're talking about the Survival Guide to Writing Fantasy.
Survival Guide, ding, yeah. To Writing Fantasy. Yep. Yes. There yep. You go.
After we're done here, it may be tonight, it may be later in the week, but just about a week or two ago, I sat down with PC Herring and Flippa Ballantyne. And we recorded what is going to be it's basically going to be called The Big Goodbye. Mm-hmm. Because of the writing and because of where my fiction is at present and because of just certain things that I've been facing throughout 2009, I've just realized that the Survival Guide has almost become it's become something that I can't dedicate enough of my time to. And I want to dedicate enough time to it, but it's just not there. So what I did, instead of just letting it just sort of fester and fade away into nothing, I went on ahead and sat down with these two other authors, and we recorded what is going to be the grand finale, or the big goodbye. I may come back to the Survival Guide. I don't know, but I wanted it to end on a more optimistic level, or on a more positive level. And so what's going to happen is that at present, I believe it's going to be a 3-part goodbye.
Okay.
And it's been a lot of fun. And I may be the Uber nemesis, but I think I'm about to hang up that mantle because, you know, I can't keep up with Merle Lafferty. You know, that is why she is mighty. I can't keep up with other podcasters like The Command Line. I just started listening to his podcast, and now I understand why he is one of the longtime heavy hitters. Mm-hmm. And I just, what I need to do is I need to focus on my own writing projects, and I need to focus on where I'm going to be as a writer in 2010. And people go, well, yeah, but, you know, it's 2010. That's next year. Well, you know what? It's November. And it's sneaking up on us very, very quickly.
No, that's very true. And I can completely understand where you're coming from. And I want to thank you for providing me with the inspiration, first of all, to be a podcaster myself.
Thank you.
And I have to tell you that I have Podcasting for Dummies sitting on my bookshelf that I'm looking at right now. And I used that quite extensively when I started thinking about how this show is going to be put together.
Yeah, I've had a lot of people tell me that. Probably my favorite one was the Backseat Producers. Tony Mast and a score of other people that would join him basically to talk about movies. And they said on episode one of Backseat Producers, there was Podcasting for Dummies sitting there, you know, right by the microphone, just in case something went wrong. They could pick up the book and flip to something to find out what they did wrong. And fortunately, they didn't have to crack a cover. And they've been doing great work. In fact, they just had their 100th episode.
Wow.
And one of the things that I got the biggest kick out of was they invited me to come on the show because during the Double Trouble push that me and Pip Ballantyne were hosting together for our last books with Dragon Moon Press, we went on a big interview circuit and we came in to podcast with those guys, and we did, no lie, we did a 3-hour show with them.
Wow.
They posted it completely intact. They didn't break it up. One three-hour show, and it was one of their most downloaded shows. And people kept saying the same thing: that didn't feel like 3 hours. So that was a good thing. But what was even funnier was that some people were saying, "I wonder if T." They put out the challenge and said, "Could T. Morris review 100 movies in 100 minutes?" And this was for their 100th show,
right?
And sure enough, they sat me down. They started the timer. And even with Skype kicking us off and having this gap in silence, when they got me back and everything was copacetic, I managed to review 124 movies within 100 minutes, and it was good fun.
Well, I think that's part of the point of podcasting too, is to have a bit of fun with it. I know one of the biggest benefits for me is getting the chance to talk to my guests. So get all of their wisdom.
Well, I appreciate that. I appreciate that. As far as, the way I look at it is one person's wisdom is another one's, okay, how did I get here again? I will be the first one to say I have made a lot of mistakes along the way, but I've also learned a good amount of not necessarily what to not do, but also if I want to go into this direction, this is what I should be doing. And that's been part of 2009, has been sort of redirecting where I'm headed. I mean, I've had a great time writing the nonfiction and doing some of the Twitter stuff. And I actually have another Twitter project that I need to finalize tonight with the publishers over at Pearson, the same people behind Sam's and Q.
Okay.
And that is, it's basically going to be another Twitter tutorial, but instead of me actually doing, you know, a book, I'm going to be doing a series of screencasts.
Okay.
And it's going to be, you know, this is how we do this on Twitter. This is how we do that on Twitter. You know, basically Twitter television is going to be the working title. Title is Twitter television. And what I will do is I will just do these little tutorials, but that will probably be the last nonfiction that I will do for some time, because I really want to get back into fiction. That's where my heart is.
Yeah. It's where you have fun.
Yeah. Yeah. And I've needed to do that. So I'm just thrilled that people are digging my stories and still discovering me in podcasting. It's a great thrill.
Well, I'm still waiting for some more Billies to come out and some more Moravi, so looking forward to both of those series.
Well, thank you very much. It may be some time before I return back to that universe, because I want to see where the chips fall with Books and Brawn. So we'll just take it one step at a time.
Yeah, that I know I enjoy your writing and I enjoy Pip's writing a lot, so I can imagine it'll be an interesting hybrid.
We think it is. So we'll see how it goes.
Very cool. And where can my listeners find you?
Well, they can find me at tmorris.com, the aforementioned birdhouserules.com. You can also find me at imaginethatstudios.com. And a quick plug for the day job. I also manage a blog and a podcast. Now, this is a blog and a podcast that I do not do a lot of writing for, but I manage the content for it. And the reason I bring it up is because it's something that I think has been overlooked in the grand aspect of how everything in social media is very social. A lot of people are sort of they're checking their brains at the door and they're not being safe. And the day job that I work for is a security company in Chantilly, Virginia. And we host a blog where security experts come in and they do different columns and they post different commentary on credit card management, credit fraud, identity theft, and identity protection, both online and in the real world. So you can see what I do on the day job front at idguardian.com. I figured I'd throw in a quick little plug for the day job just to make sure that they know that I'm working hard even on the weekends.
Very good. Well, thank you again, T. I really appreciate the time you've taken, and I'm looking forward to the farewell episode of Survival Guide.
Thank you, and I'll be talking to you again soon.
Sounds good.
So, Tabs, this was a great idea. You and I writing short stories for each other's podcasts.
It is a great idea, PG, but I wouldn't exactly call your story short.
Point taken. And I just want to say, for the record, that your story for my Tales of the Children podcast is just wonderful. You captured the feel of my fantasy setting just perfect.
Oh, thank you, PG.
Of course, we did have to remove Spike.
It wasn't really Spike.
Uh-huh. Vampire, bad poet, blonde hair, pines for an avatar of the child of love named Duffy.
Okay, maybe it was Spike.
So, Tabs, you want me to record my story for you? I have time.
No, got it all covered. Full voice cast and everything.
What about the main character? I can voice him if you want. After all, I patterned him after me.
He's European, but not Southern.
How about the narrator? Certainly I'd be good for that.
PG, I have an entire studio at my disposal. You need to concentrate on the tales of children and my story.
But no one else has ever podcast one of my stories before.
Let it go, PG. Let it go.
Stories of Wolfram and Hart is a short story podcast anthology set within the Angel Between the Lines podcast. Visit angelbetweenthelines.com for more information on this podcast and return on November 16th, 2009 to download P.G. Holyfield's long short story, Exit Strategy.
Find out more about Tales of the Children and P.G. Holyfield's upcoming debut novel, Murder at Abaddon Hill, over at pgholyfield.com. And then on November 18th, 2009 at 9:30 Eastern Time, join P.G. over at stickam.com/P.G. Holyfield for the live video recording of my short story, Love Sacrificial Song.
How about...
No.
I could...
No.
Hand out flyers?
That's my boyfriend. No.
And that's our show. If you'd like to leave feedback, comments, or questions, you can call the voicemail line at 206-203-2031. Or you can send me an email at feedback@getpublishedpodcast.com. Send me a friend request on Facebook or friend feed at Michael Plested, or follow me on Twitter at mplested. And before I let you go, I could really use some comments and ratings on iTunes too. I'd love to hear from you. Until next time, work hard, never give up, and maybe you too can get published. Thanks for listening.
Get Published is an Irreverent Muse production.